hair of the head coming clean off the skull. Did Kossior stare down his captors with anger? Did he taunt them through the blood and pain, one eye half closed? Did he beg, ask to speak with Stalin, or demand it? Did he insist on his innocence until his voice went hoarse? Or did he save his energy and breath, knowing there was no point? If Kossior had to stand in water for days on end, he did not break. If the NKVD subjected him to the swallow, where he was hoisted up by his arms and legs tied behind him, he did not break. It is unknown whether Kossior's refusal to break earned him the grudging respect of his captors or simply angered them more. It remains unclear whether they had their eventual ace in the hole the entire time and were toying with him, or if their idea only came when nothing else seemed to work. Or perhaps there was a line even the NKVD wanted to avoid crossing if there remained any possibility of avoiding it. What we do know is that the interrogators brought in Kossior's 16-year-old daughter Tamara and raped her in front of him. That did it. That finally broke Stanislav Kossior. Kossior duly signed the confession that he, an ethnic Pole, had been a Polish spy. His execution was not immediate. He managed to outlive Tamara, who committed suicide by throwing herself in front of a train. Whether Tamara's death should technically be counted as one of the NKVD's victims is an academic question. It is unlikely it was she who the New York Times had in mind when they published a 2017 opinion piece explaining why women had better sex under socialism. But history has at least recorded her name, unlike those of so many thousands of others whose very existence has been entirely wiped away. The trials as a whole left viewers worldwide with a logical dilemma. It was Granville Hicks himself who pointed out that there were only two real conclusions one could draw from the events. If these men were innocent, he wrote years later, the administration of the Soviet Union was a vicious, ruthless tyranny. But if, on the other hand, they were guilty, then the leadership of the communist movement had been desperately corrupt from the very beginning. Yet the show trials were, even on, or rather especially on, those men and women who are Western media influencers of their time. As George Orwell put it, what was frightening about these trials was not the fact that they happened, for obviously such things are necessary in a totalitarian society, but the eagerness of Western intellectuals to justify them. Take the case of Dorothy Parker. She was the Samantha Bee of her day, and her comrade James Thurber, the Stephen Colbert. The two were part of the famous Algonquin Roundtable, which spent the 1920s meeting for lunch every day and exchanging bon mots in New York City's Algonquin Hotel. The group was strongly associated with the New Yorker magazine and its sensibilities. As Parker herself later described it, they came there to be heard by one another. Ooh, did you hear what I said last night? People look at it rosily now, and it wasn't. I promise you, it was no good. It was the terrible day of the wisecrack, so there didn't have to be any truth. There was nothing memorable about them, about any of them. A century later, Parker remained synonymous with American wit and was probably the first woman in the United States to be known for her sharp tongue. Her life story was made into an inexorable 1994 film entitled Mrs. Parker and the Vicious Circle, wherein Jennifer Jason Leigh drunkenly stands up and spontaneously delivers Parker's sayings in front of various audiences over the course of 90 minutes. Though Parker never did write that, if you don't have anything nice to say about someone, come sit next to me, it certainly does read in her voice. As a theater reviewer, she quipped that, I know who wrote those lyrics, and I know the names of the people in the cast, but I'm not going to tell on them. When an editor pressured her for overdue work, she replied that she was too fucking busy and vice versa. Men seldom make passes at girls who wear glasses was originally a couplet of hers entitled News Item, and there was that wholesale libel in the Yale prom. If all the girls attending it were laid end to end, Mrs. Parker said, she wouldn't be at all surprised. Parker was also a strong advocate of social justice and threw aside her trademark sarcasm and irony when it came to the issues that mattered to her. In 1927, it was the Sacco and Vanzetti case that gripped America. The two self-described anarchists were accused of murdering a bank guard during an armed robbery and accordingly sentenced to death. Progressives around the nation were taken with the cause of the immigrant men, and the case dragged on for years. In 1927, Parker was arrested and fined a paltry $5 for loitering and sauntering after taking part in a rally for their defense. It would be to no avail. The pair would be electrocuted in August of that year. Yet when it came to Stalin's trials of innocent men, Parker and her comrades had an entirely different approach. As literary critic Lionel Trilling wrote in his 1966 essay, Young in the 30s, in any view of the American cultural situation, the importance of the radical movement of the 30s cannot be overestimated. It may be said to have created the American intellectual class as we now know it in its great size and influence. It fixed the character of this class as being, through all mutations of opinion, predominantly of the left. And quite apart from opinion, the political tendency of the 30s defined the style of the class. From that radicalism came the moral urgency, the sense of crisis, and the concern with personal salvation that marked the existence of American intellectuals. Indeed, a large cross-section of the American intelligentsia tripped over themselves to defend Stalin's purges and the executions that followed as a result of them. A letter to that effect was published in the Daily Worker on April 28, 1938, and then repeated for good measure in New Masses on May 3rd, the same exact day that Stanislav Kossior was arrested. Parker's name was easy to miss among the many signatories. It was below that of Granville Hicks. None of the people who added their names to the letter had a gun to their head. It was their free choice to go out of their way to make known their support of Stalin's actions and to take a public stand on his behalf, to use their elevated status to let average Americans know how important it was for the Soviet Union to have the right, if not the duty, to execute its own citizens. We, the undersigned, are fully aware of the confusion that exists with regard to the Moscow trials and the real facts about the situation in the Soviet Union, it began. Simply put, the reports of the trials have, by sheer weight of evidence, established a clear presumption of the guilt of the defendants. The basic American liberal concept of a presumption of innocence until proven guilty, a basic element of human rights designed to protect the powerless against the accusatory state, was gladly flipped on its head. In fact, the influencers claimed, most newspapers have discarded the earlier charges of frame-up and now admit the validity of the trials. This might have been perhaps less of a commentary on the validity of the trials than on the decency of most newspapers. The alleged point of the confusion was in part to obscure the truth about the achievements of the Soviet Union as recorded by honest progressive opinion. These achievements supposedly included magnificent gains in industry and agriculture. The letter went on to repeat Stalin's claim that the defendants resorted to duplicity and conspiracy and allied themselves with long-standing enemies of the Soviet Union. Degeneration may therefore be charged to the defendants and not to the Soviet Union, which gained strength internally and externally by the prevention of treason and the eradication of spies and wreckers. Eradication, of course, being a euphemism for the death penalty, with wreckers in practice being anyone who is disobedient or even skeptical, or has simply been accused of it. But again, any setbacks in the Soviet Union weren't the fault of communism or the USSR or Stalin. It was the fault of those men who had been captured and imprisoned. By this point in time, there had already been concern in Hollywood and in Washington over those Americans who preferred the USSR to the United States and were secretly plotting with the Soviet government. Members of the Communist Party of the United States were complaining about the personal costs of joining the party when their beloved communist country made membership in any other political party, even the past, grounds for imprisonment, labor camps, and certain death. In an amazing bit of projection, the celebrities claimed that the Soviet Union's growing vitality and self-defense measures restrained its foes from open attack, so that the opponents of the Soviet Union have therefore been forced to resort to covert means. Supposedly, these enemies have disseminated reactionary propaganda and financial patronage within the USSR. It was not that Soviet agents had been placed throughout the West, but the other way around. If anything, it was Hitler who was pulling the strings in US circles, not Stalin. No one denies the penetration of the American continent by fascist propaganda. The letter ended by asking American liberals to support the efforts of the Soviet Union to free itself from insidious internal dangers. In other words, not only were the purges and the hundreds of thousands sent to camps something to tolerate or explain away, no, Stalin should have the backing of every good American leftist with a conscience. As the motto went, communism is 20th century Americanism. The same editors and writers who once spoke up for Sacco and Vanzetti, Lyons later wrote, who presumably cherished the memory of the world response to a Dreyfus or a Mendel Bayless case, now gave every benefit of the doubt to an omnipotent state and its firing squads rather than to its victims. There were no intellectual acrobatics which the fellow travelers would not undertake to save their lovely faith in Russia. Year after year, they had accepted and explained away horror and super horror, falsifications of history, corruption, terror, man-made famine, the death penalty for minor thefts, the punishment of relatives for alleged crimes committed by members of their family thousands of miles away, capital punishment for young children, concentration camps with a population running into millions. In some ways, the love affair with Stalin was even stronger in the United Kingdom than in the United States. The Englishman H.G. Wells was a major pioneer in the field of science fiction, with books like The Time Machine, War of the Worlds, and The Invisible Man still widely read today. Wells' genre of science fiction is not to be confused with Russia's scientific socialism, which is the fiction that, among other things, a planned economy would have no shortages or surpluses. The experts would know exactly how much and what needed to be produced, and they would make that and only that. In 1934, Wells had become one of the lucky few, either from the USSR or abroad, who managed to interview the surprisingly reclusive Stalin. At one point, regarding the imminent collapse of capitalism as a functioning system, Wells chided Stalin, saying that, "It seems to me that I am more to the left than you." While Wells had a strong reputation of being a socialist in the United Kingdom, he also had a strong reputation in general. If Stalin was more to the center than Wells, then clearly the leader's ideology couldn't be all that bad. By definition, it wasn't that extreme if the mainstream Wells was further to the fringe than Stalin was. "I have never met a man more candid, fair, and honest," Wells wrote of Stalin, "and it is to these qualities and to nothing occult and sinister that he owes his tremendous, undisputed ascendancy in Russia." George Orwell was a hardcore leftist throughout his life, and like so many others around the world, made the journey to Spain to take part in the Spanish Civil War, the battle between a broad coalition of leftists, from Stalinists to anarchists, against the ultra-nationalist forces of Francisco Franco, was in many ways perceived to be a proxy for the growing European conflict between fascism and its opponents. What Orwell saw permanently turned him against authoritarian communism, becoming one of its fiercest and most perceptive critics with his masterpieces 1984 and Animal Farm. As he later put it, "Every line of serious work that I've written since 1936 has been written directly or indirectly against totalitarianism and for democratic socialism, as I understand it." Yet in 1938, Orwell's British publisher, Victor Gollancz, refused to publish Homage to Catalonia, Orwell's memoir about his Spanish experience and what he saw as communist duplicity against their supposed allies. Gollancz had co-founded the Left Book Club, a list that catered to socialists and published several exclusive titles. To paraphrase Orwell's famous quote, "Some leftists were more equal to others, and criticism of Stalinist communism was not to be done." The upshot is that, Orwell wrote, "If from time to time you express a mild distaste for slave labor camps or one candidate elections, you're either insane or actuated by the worst motives." Another prominent British intellectual was the aforementioned Harold Laski, whose political career would culminate in becoming the UK's Labour Party chairman. He went even further than most, making a point to praise Stalin's prosecutor as doing what an ideal minister of justice would do if we had such a person in Great Britain. Laski would eventually get in trouble for announcing that if labor did not obtain what it needed by general consent, we shall have to use violence, even if it means a revolution. It's understandable why Laski was the inspiration for the villain in Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead. In Laski, Rand saw the man who couldn't be and knows it, someone who hated the good because it was the good. As she recalled, "After seeing Laski, I just had to remember how he lectured. His mannerism, the pseudo-intellectual snideness, the whole manner of speaking on important subjects with inappropriate sarcasm as his only weapon, acting as if he were a charming scholar in a drawing room, but you could sense the bared teeth behind the smile. You could feel something evil." Pat Sloan was a British communist who spent some time in the USSR. He freely told his fellow citizens that, "Compared with the significance of that term in Britain, Soviet imprisonment stands out as an almost enjoyable experience. For the essence of Soviet imprisonment is isolation from the rest of the community, together with other persons similarly isolated, with the possibility to do useful work at the place of isolation, to earn a wage for this work, and to participate in running the isolation settlement or prison in the same way as the children participate in running their school or the workers their factory. The Soviet labor camp provides a freedom for its inmates not usual in our own prisons in this country," he went on to say. Yet it's not merely the left-wing fringe of the intellectual class that came to such conclusions. The Nation and the New Republic were and remain highly respected outlets that Americans turn to learn about the issues of the day and how they should feel about them. As Lyons commemorated, "What was the Nation's first reaction to the announcement of the initial Trotskyist trial? Not even decent astonishment. It was to be expected that under the velvet glove of the new Soviet constitution," it wrote, "there would still be the firm outlines of the Iron Hand. There could be no doubt the dictatorship in Russia is dying and that a new democracy is slowly being born." The impending death of thousands of communists was thus another confirmation that the dictatorship is dying. The gallant New Republic, in its first reaction, blandly assumed that the fantastic charges compounded by the GPU were true. "Perhaps the deepest lesson to be learned from the Russian trial," it declared, "is the profound, unchangeable stubbornness of human nature. From the standpoint of practical expediency, these men had little to gain and much to lose by their effort to bring down the Soviet state in ruins." Perhaps the deepest lesson here might not be about the profound, unchangeable stubbornness of human nature. Rather, it might have something to do with the profound, unchangeable stubbornness of the Nation, the New Republic, and other such journals. The very same outlets that still presume to hector Americans on a daily basis about ethics and decency without shame or even irony. As horrific as it was for Stalin and his men to turn family members into hostages, they weren't always used to leverage confessions or the like. Loyalty to family was a quintessentially bourgeois worldview, the private interest over the public good, and any hint of that was anathema to good communists. Husbands and wives turned against one another with ease. Just being married to an enemy of the people was in and of itself illegal, a crime that a husband, or far more frequently a wife, could do very little to deny. Things were even stricter for those in the military. Starting in 1934, a military man who fled when abroad would subject not merely his spouse, but his entire family to get sent to a prison camp. Mikhail Kalinin was chairman of the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet, the Soviet Union's head of state, but even that could not protect his wife from being arrested, tortured, and sentenced in 1938 to 15 years for supposedly being aligned with Trotsky. Kalinin knew better than to protest and dutifully carried on with his work. Paulina Zhemchujina was Vyacheslav Molotov's wife. His name remains with us in part due to the Molotov cocktail, invented by the Finns to fight the Russians. Molotov was second only to Stalin, and Zhemchujina served as Moscow's de facto first lady after Stalin's second wife killed herself, or was she murdered, in 1932. When Stalin announced the arrest of yet another espionage rig, Molotov suspected that his wife would be included in the group. "What will become of Polina Semyonovna?" he asked. "What a question," Stalin barked. "Vyacheslav Mikhailovich still doesn't know how the Soviet government deals with imperialist spies." Molotov's wife was soon arrested and sentenced to 5 years in a labor camp. Nor was Stalin's own family safe. He personally approved the execution of his first widow's brother, his very own brother-in-law, which was carried out with all good haste. Her mother was arrested and imprisoned as well. Stalin's second widow's brother-in-law was likewise shot. As marriage itself thereby became fraught with danger, so did the Soviet system attempt to use children against their own parents in other ways. Just as George Washington was mythologized as having admitted in his boyhood to chopping down a cherry tree because I cannot tell a lie, the Soviet authorities developed folk heroes of a sort in order to spread moral messages on desirable behavior among the population. Most notorious of these was the story of Pavlik Morozov, a young boy who turned in his kulak father to the authorities for hoarding grain. Pavlik was then allegedly killed by his dad. In doing so, he became a martyr throughout the USSR with statues built in his honor. The message was so unambiguous, even a child could understand it, because of course, the story was targeted precisely toward children. If your parents break the law, there is no higher moral response than to turn them in, even if it costs you your own life. The youngest themselves were not free from being arrested and put on trial, and getting them to confess was child's play. It only took a single night of interrogation to get one 10-year-old detainee to admit that he had joined a fascist organization at the age of 7. Other kids who were not suspects themselves were forced to publicly approve of the arrests and executions of their parents for having been spies. Their entire class or school would assemble, and the student would be berated until they denounced their mother and or father in front of their fellow classmates. Children had been Bolshevik targets from the beginning. Russian author Sergei Maslov recounts the May 1920 arrest of a band of Moscow pickpockets, all between the ages of 11 and 15. The children were confined in a cellar and isolated from the other prisoners. Threats and promises of reward were alternately used to make the children point out their accomplices. After some fruitless attempts to make them speak, several employees of the Cheka entered the cellar, pounded the children with their fists, and, having knocked them down, kicked them with their heavy boots. They were dragged daily about the town on trams, in motor cars, and taken to railway stations to point out their accomplices. At first, the children tried to pretend they knew no one. They were still more barbarously beaten that night, and they began to betray their associates. This torture went on for a fortnight. If a child had the bad luck not to meet or point out a comrade, he would be cruelly thrashed. To escape the savage punishment, the children finally pointed out innocent boys whom they did not know. After 3 weeks of this, the young thieves were like small, hunted animals expecting an imminent death. They sobbed, trembled, and shrieked in their sleep. The adult inmates, hardened prisoners themselves, had never heard such heart-rending cries as those of the children when they understood that they were going back to the cellar. There was a brief moment when children in several large cities organized in an attempt to fight back, calling themselves revenge for our parents. The students knew perfectly well that their families were innocent. Their youthful naivete is understandable, but no less tragic. They issued a leaflet arguing against the mass arrest of so many loyal citizens, and then they were, of course, virtually all arrested themselves. Naturally, so were their siblings and any remaining parents, in this case for having failed to denounce the pamphleteers for their counter-revolutionary activities. The number of cases of families being destroyed overnight was endless. A man could be arrested for whatever reason, and then his wife for the crime of being married to him, leaving their children effectively orphaned. To compound the suffering, there was an enormous disincentive for other families and their own children to take an interest in what was happening, lest they now appear to have been conspiring with enemies of the people. Simply calling attention to the needs of such a child could easily be taken as criticism of the government. "Surely you're not implying we would let young people suffer, comrade, if not Stalin personally." One day there would be a family, and the next the child was not only alone, but completely socially isolated and shunned by everyone around them. The epidemic of hopeless children who understandably started taking their own lives caused hand-wringing at the Kremlin. Some families did their best to help such cases, but it was understood very well that housing a child of an enemy of the people was done at great risk. After the assistant chief of Red Army Intelligence and his wife were executed, their apartment had been seized by the government. Their 13-year-old daughter had nowhere to go and was taken in by a family whose daughter was a close friend of hers. Concerned, the foster father went to the head of the NKVD secretary for advice as to how to best handle the situation. After agreeing that the matter is a very delicate one, the secretary gave his thoughts. "At any rate," he said, "it isn't proper for you to keep her. My advice to you is try to get rid of her." The father, of course, did as he was advised. The fate of such young girls put out into the street can be imagined, but perhaps shouldn't be. Those children who were a little older joined gangs and were often thereby arrested for genuine, if perhaps unavoidable, criminal behavior. Soviet prison survivor Gustav Herling-Grudzinski discussed their lifestyle in his memoir. Juvenile delinquents, like the boys in the cell, are the plague of the Soviet prisons. Unnaturally excited, always ferreting in other men's bunks and inside their own trousers, they give themselves up passionately to the only two occupations of their lives, theft and self-abuse. Almost all of them either have no parents